Following program has been furnished and paid by Nathan P. Ross, CPA, and KSEV is not responsible for its content or the products or services offered.
Welcome to the Be a Planner Show with Nathan Ross, CPA, a show that helps you learn how planners can generate significantly more wealth now. Nathan will answer your questions about business or personal finance, or how to increase current cash flows and generate retirement savings to make sure you're on the right path, and so much more. Whatever your financial goal, Nathan can get you there faster. And now, here's your host, Nathan Ross.
Welcome to this week's Be a Planner Show with Nathan Ross, CPA. We're glad you could join us. And unfortunately, we're not going to be talking cyber today. Mr. AI Wynn called in sick today, so we hope he gets better. In the meantime, we've got plenty of other topics to talk about. We're going to revisit the budget, the federal budget today, and talk about the DOGE, the Department of Government Efficiency plans, and we might try to assess what's really possible to cut on the federal budget. You know, it's, boy, I tell you, it's depressing taking a look at what the numbers work out to, and I tell you, you know, we're spending $7 trillion a year. That's a lot of money, but cutting $2 trillion is also a lot of money. And it's going to be, it's going to be interesting to see how a couple of business folks like Elon Musk and Vivek Vaswamy, I think I'm saying that right, approach it, because we need some new thinking other than what prevails in Washington, that's for sure. But in any event, we'll circle back momentarily to talk more about that. But and we're also going to visit the U.S. debt clock .org site again. It's been a while since I've talked specific numbers on that front, but it's you know, in line with what DOGE is looking at as well, obviously. For those of you that have existing advisors, I want to remind you that you need to discuss anything you hear on the show dealing with tax strategy or any type of investing, maybe that some of my clients and I do with real estate, private partnerships, or any other financial type strategies, decision points, etc. Make sure you consult with your advisors before you jump into the pool, so to speak. And if you don't have advisors, then we would welcome a chance to talk with you or review your data if you'll go to our website at beaplanner.com. That's beaplanner.com. And complete, at the forms link that's out there, complete the first of the four steps, four forms, etc., to give us enough background material to where we can actually speak to you about your goals and objectives and how we might be able to work with you. Let's see here. The for those of you that have been sleeping under a rock, you know the DOGE, or D-O-G-E, Department of Government Efficiency, is the new department that Mr. Trump has established, and he's reached out to Elon Musk and Vivek Vaswamy to help corral or curtail government spending. It's out of control. We collect about $5 trillion a year in tax receipts. We're spending just over 7, and that doesn't appear to be diminishing anytime soon. The latest 10-year study that CBO, the Congressional Budget Office, produced shows that for the next 10 years, that's the end game or end line for them when they do their annual 10-year update to advise Congress, you know, this is where we're headed based on current projections, current, you know, interest rates on the existing debt. Since interest, you may not realize, again, we talk about it often on this show, interest is now the third largest budgetary component in our federal budget. Third largest, just over $1.1 trillion for the past year, fiscal year of the government. So that was the year that ended this past September 30. So it's now number three out of the top four. It has been in the fourth position for quite a while, but in any event, according to the CBO report, 10 years out, that'd be 2034, interest will be the number one component of the federal budget. That's insane. And at that point, I believe, I forget right offhand. I want to say it'll be, it'll be several trillion dollars at that point. I want to say it's as much as $5 trillion. I don't have that number handy. But whatever it is, it's money we don't have. And so the cumulative debt continues to rise, and at that point, 10 years out, it's anticipated to be somewhere in the $54 to $55 trillion dollar range. It's an incredible number, and again, it's because we're spending more than we have. And currently, if you look at the U.S. debt clock, which is at usdebtclock.org, and you look at the total debt, it's now $36,205,725,000,000 and some change. It's a lot of money, and you know the speed at which it increases, it's somewhere between 6 to 8 billion per day, I believe, is the current number. And it can't continue. I mean, obviously it can't continue. We're spending through the last remaining portion of the discretionary part of the U.S. annual budget. It's will be gone by roughly 2029, give or take a year. And at that point, we will no longer be able to pay 100% of the interest on that borrowed, on the debt. And so, you know, if the math has ever indicated any more clearly than what it does right now, that taxes will go up. I don't remember a time in my 40 years as practicing, or 42 years as practicing as a CPA, I can never remember a time where, when, you know, we would hear financial commentators, prognosticators indicate that, you know, we're going to have to pay more in taxes. It was never said with a set of facts that we have now, where we've literally borrowed over 100% of the U.S. GDP already. We're at that mark, and you know, we're headed higher unless something's done. And in any event, and the main reason I'm discussing this is I want you to understand the steps you can take. Some of you, probably most of you, can take to avoid the calamity that's going to come from our slothfulness at the federal spending level. And again, I'm rooting for Elon Musk and Vivek. I'm definitely rooting, but Ramaswamy, you know, those guys tend to be very optimistic simply because they've watched government for quite a while. They see the waste, but, you know, unfortunately, a business does not function operationally quite like the government does. And when you look at all the little power fiefdoms within the government bureaucracy, I don't want to say the deep state necessarily, it probably those circles probably do coincide if you looked at the spending fiefdoms in the deep state. But you know, they can't just wave a magic wand. They've got to get Congress to go along, or at least they got to get President Trump. Some of the federal spending could probably, I'm not sure how much, but it definitely could be affected by executive order. But, you know, that's going to cost money. You think the people that are getting those funds now are going to just roll over and say, oh, okay, I get it. We don't get all our money this year. While there's other departments that will get their money plus their money in some cases. And so there's going to be fights, and you know, it's all talk until you wake up and realize your ox is the one that's getting gored, and then you're going to do everything you can to block or otherwise shove the impact off to another department within the government. But you know, the problem we've got is that of our $7 trillion annual expenditure, we've got a total of let's see, $3 trillion, $4 trillion. Most of it is consumed by things that, you know, most people are going to tell you, well, you can't cut my Social Security, or you can't cut Medicare or Medicaid. You know, a lot of people need that to live every month. And then you're going to have others look at the nearly $1 trillion defense expenditure, and in light of what's going on in the world today, do we dare cut defense spending? I mean, the answer is yes, we do. We have to be very careful, but we can quit buying the $90,000 bag of bolts I read about a couple weeks ago. I believe Vivek had brought that up. I'm sure that is repeated over and over and over. And so we're going to have to make systemic changes to the way the government does business. And, you know, there was an article on foxbusiness.com this past week. Let me see what date this was. It was December 6th. So what's that, a couple of days ago? Two days ago. And the title is Doge Can Find the $2 trillion in Spending Cuts Musk Wants, But the Savings Could Take a While. And I would say that's the least of our worries. Guess what happens if you don't start cutting? You won't get there, and then it gets worse. But experts, quote unquote, say trillions in fact is right under Doge's nose, but it will likely take a decade to trim. Well, you know what? That would be great if we could do it in a decade. I would say that may be optimistic, but you know, when Musk was asked recently on the campaign trail how much he thought the Department of Government Efficiency, Doge, could, quote, rip out from the Biden-Harris administration's $6.5 trillion budget. So that's $1.5 trillion higher than it. Well, no, it's not. I'm sorry. It's right at what we're spending now. I think he said, quote, I think we could do at least $2 trillion, end quote. And I tend to agree. I mean, again, just using common sense and some historical points of reference, I think it's absolutely possible, and I think that whether it's possible or not, you're going to have to do it at some point, because people will quit borrowing or loaning rather to us when you can't cover the interest on the U.S. debt. It's going to either mean that we won't have people buying treasury bills and treasury bonds, etc. Or if they buy them, they're going to want a higher rate of interest on those auctions that take place routinely. But even the ardent proponents, or ardent proponents of rooting out government waste and downsizing, are skeptical that such an amount could be cut from the annual budget. Well, again, you got to try, and I'm going to suggest again that there's a lot of policies that cost us money, and you just look at, frankly, you just look at the administrative function within government and realize how inefficient it is. Let's see, I was going to point out something else here in this article. You've got the naysayers that indicate, you know, getting $2 trillion a year of deficit reduction, if you do really hard stuff, is extremely unlikely. That's a quote by a gentleman with the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget, CRFB, bipartisan think tank that looks at such matters. $2 trillion, according to Mr. Goldwine, who's with the CRFB, points out that $2 trillion is more than the total U.S. government spends on non-defense appropriations, and I'm not sure where he's getting his number, because I guess if you are not counting certain mandates, that may be true, but it appears to me if defense is currently just under $1 trillion and we're spending $7 trillion, I'm not sure how that math works out, but it's a lot of money. I mean, I agree with the point he's making, is that, hey, you know, some people don't believe there's $2 trillion of waste, and I guess maybe it's the definition of waste. But I'll tell you this, there's a lot of congressmen, senators, and representatives that they're starting to get it, and the least of which is David Schweikert, the Arizona Republican that's spoken at length in many videos on YouTube, where he brings the receipts on the different policies and different areas that are ripe for being considered for cutting. But, you know, the issue, the elephant in the room that nobody wants to talk about publicly, is that outside of interest expense, which, as I indicated, now exceed even defense spending, it's hard to believe, the budget is $6 trillion. And most of the largest spending program is Social Security. Actually, it's Medicare and Medicaid, according to the U.S. debt clock. I'm not sure. I mean, that's part of our quandary when we look at these numbers. Depending on which window of the room you look into, you get competing views. But, you know, according to the USDebtClock.org, Medicare, Medicaid is a combined, to date, this year, this budget cycle, it's $1.8 trillion. And Social Security is 1.5. So whatever the case may be, they're one and two, respectively. And defense is way behind at the moment. And who knows what that will turn into with all the hot spots we have around the world, and getting hotter by the moment. I reference Mr. Assad's flight out of Syria, literally, overnight this past night. And, you know, who knows what that vacuum or how that vacuum is going to be filled, but it won't be by one of our friends. It could be worse than having him in power, but 50-year reign of terror, I guess you might say, with the Assad family has now come to an end. And you can count on the fact that somehow the U.S. is going to be spending money, more money, on that part of the world. And I hope we choose to outsource that to someone like Israel that knows what they're doing when it comes to the Middle East and military. Let's do this. Let's go ahead and take a break, our first break today, and we'll be back momentarily with more of this week's Be a Planner Show with Nathan Ross, CPA.
Hey, if you'd like to contact Nathan for questions during the show today or during the week, you can text him at 713-581-0195, 713-581-0195, or you can send an email to Nathan at npross.com, Nathan at npross.com.
Did you know 76% of Americans are concerned they won't have a secure retirement? BeAPlanner.com shows how private real estate partnerships can increase current cash flow and retirement savings. There are three options to control your 401 and IRAs, but only one will double your retirement lifestyle. BeAPlanner.com for the Be A Planner Show with CPA Nathan Ross.
Are you a veteran who served offshore of the Republic of Vietnam between 1962 and 1975? Blue Water Navy veterans and their family members may now qualify for compensation and survivor benefits for health conditions linked to herbicide exposure such as Agent Orange. To learn more, call 1-800-749-8387 or go to va.gov and search Blue Water Navy. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs.
Okay, welcome back to more of this week's Be A Planner Show with Nathan Ross, CPA. And for those of you that might have tuned in to hear our cyber version of the show today, I'm sad to report that Mr. A.I. Nguyen was taken ill over the last couple days. We don't think it's anything serious, but when you've got a sore throat radio becomes very difficult. So anyway, he's recovering, and we hope he'll be able to join us next Sunday. In the meantime, we've been discussing the federal budget once again, along with the Department of Government Efficiency that we're hoping, we're rooting for. And, you know, you were talking a little bit about the steep climb that this is going to be, but the CRFB, the Committee for Responsible Federal Budget, they, while saying that they're not quite sure that, you know, DOGE can get to the $2 trillion a year, they do agree that there are trillions over a decade that would not be that difficult, which, man, that'd make a big start towards getting the budget under control. CRFB believes that President-elect Trump could save the U.S. $1.4 trillion alone over the next 10 years just by reversing President Biden's executive actions. And the nonpartisan group, that's again CRFB, also identified another $700 billion and deficit reduction options that are low-hanging fruit, meaning that they're easy and they're relatively bipartisan. You know, both sides of the aisle would agree. So, you know, that's when you think about it, the presidential executive actions are always expensive. I mean, it's amazing how presidents, both sides, not just Democrats, it's both sides, Democrats and Republicans, by a stroke of the pen, execute, you know, some action that they deem, you know, important to the country. And in Biden's case, probably the biggest savings is the forgiveness of debt for student loans. And I don't have that number handy, but it's a huge amount of money, billions and billions, probably hundreds of billions over that period. But in any event, I would just suggest that, okay, great, let's take the easy stuff first. Let's show some improvement, show some want to, quote unquote, and let's get started, because this is a serious problem that won't just affect us, it'll affect the whole world, because as America goes, so everyone goes around the world. And the world's in precarious position right now when it comes to financial issues, and has been for a while. You know, the Russian economy is on the ropes, the Chinese economy is on the ropes, and you know, the only economies that aren't big enough to save the rest of us, right? So we've got to spend within our means and not exacerbate the problem. Think about just $1 trillion of interest expense every year is what we're faced with. And that's going to go up again. That number will be, I believe it's $5 trillion 10 years out, but that's just amazing. But anyway, you know, I want to go back to a topic we were talking about on last Friday's show about investing in real estate with your self-directed IRA and or your solo K. And I wanted to differentiate between you executing a single family rental property purchase with that of multifamily. And I'm deviating from the deficit discussion momentarily, but I will try to circle back to that. I want to see if I can find an article I have in the archives of that really breaks down the categories of spending, so we can all remember, you know, this is how our money is being passed out. But anyway, one thing that I want to point out to you, and it makes it a little bit difficult to execute the single family purchase if you're the type of investor, which I don't recommend, but you know, there are a lot of people. In fact, I've got clients that like to do this. They'll buy a property and then they start fixing it up, and they don't hire contractors. They like to do it themselves. Well, when you're talking about your retirement funds being all or a part of the purchase, providing the capital for purchasing a property, and you may recall that last Friday I discussed, or this past Friday, I discussed the ability for one to take out a loan, a non-recourse loan, which it has to be. It cannot be recourse. And for those of you that don't understand that term, one of them means non-recourse means that the lender can only look to the property if the loan isn't met. So in other words, a foreclosure could occur against the property, but they could not go after your personal assets, because that would be a breach of the prohibited party rules in the IRA arena. And so you are prohibited from, just think of it as touching the property. You can't go out and repaint that home. You can't go out and undertake labor of any kind on that property. You can manage it. You can manage the asset. Think of it as asset management. So you can work on a refinance. You could do things of that nature, perhaps review leases or make management decisions via a management company. And that's really the best solution to keep you from stubbing your toe, is have a property manager involved. And that could save you from a potential breach of those rules. And it's pretty painful if you get detected, let's say, of having breached that rule. Theoretically, all the funds in your IRA, not just the funds that you put in to that particular property, are subject to being taxed at your, whatever your current incremental or marginal tax bracket is for the year, and you pay a penalty of 100% of that tax. So just think of it in round numbers. If you start off with 100% of your money, you end up with somewhere between probably 30 to 40% after the dust settles and you've paid the tax. And that's on all of your IRA funds. That's not just the, you know, 150 grand you put into that property. So, you know, with the multifamily approach, you're going to invest in, typically an entity, in other words, a lead partner, sponsor, syndicator. These terms are somewhat interchangeable. They go find the property. They undertake management where they're adding contractors and leasing staff and other administrative employees. In other words, they're doing all the heavy lifting. They find the debt. They shoulder, typically, it's them or the team, shoulders any kind of guarantee. We hope it's non-recourse, qualified non-recourse, where the property, again, serves as the collateral. But in any event, it's easier not to stub your toe if you're investing your retirement monies in a private partnership syndication, typically involving multifamily, so that you're not exposed to inadvertently making a bad decision when it comes to undertaking work on a property. But in any event, and there's other reasons why multifamily, you know, is typically a more passive. We want passive real estate investments, and you know, there's always some younger people. As you get older, what you'll realize is there's always some younger people raring to get out of bed in the morning and go run those old Class C apartment buildings that we've renovated and brought them up to market rents, and hopefully they're in great locations where they stay occupied and increase in value, because that's how we make money. And I guess the way we make money between the two types of real estate is also critical. You know, with a single family property, your exit success is determined by your neighbors. And you are probably thinking, well, what do you mean by that? You know, I'm the one running my property, or I'm the one that's in charge of the property. Well, your cap on the top amount that you can get out of a single family property is dictated by what your neighbors sold their property for earlier, be it 2 weeks or 2 months. Whereas in the multifamily game, multifamily is more like a business. You know, the bottom line on each multifamily property on an income statement is what we look at generally. It's not exactly the bottom line. It's the net operating income, which includes revenues less operating expenses. And then, you know, a lender or an investor will apply a cap rate against those earnings and determine how much the property is worth. That's the cap on the top level of what you can take. And it's much different. You're not waiting for the market to move. I mean, indirectly, yeah, you are. You're hoping rents go up at all times, obviously. But the real wait is for you to get the property renovated and, you know, add the missing amenities that, you know, when you bought it, it was didn't have. It was had significant deferred maintenance. You take care of that. You make the property nice again. But in any event, and in doing so, you're able typically to raise the rents on that property. And then that in turn increases the net operating income as you move forward. Thus, you have a chance with a multifamily property to see a significant boost in value, not overnight, but certainly over a year or two once you get that property up to market level amenities and are able to raise the rent accordingly. And that may involve emptying out the property and bringing new tenants in. But in any event, let's go ahead and take our last break, and we'll circle back here momentarily with more of this week's Be a Planner show with Nathan Ross, CPA.
People always coming up to me and asking, what's your secret? With all you do, your attitude just seems to be so good. How do you keep it? Well, I'm not the Dalai Lama, but I'll try to offer up a few words of advice. You better get to living.
Hey, if you'd like to contact Nathan for questions during the show today or during the week, you can text him at 713-581-0195, 713-581-0195, or you can send an email to Nathan at nprawls.com, Nathan at nprawls.com.
BeAPlanner.com wants to ask you, When's the last time your tax pro called with a way to save you taxes? Seriously, do you want to work with a planner or a reporter? A planner knows which tax code sections are the best wealth accumulation tools. Less tax, more profit. Learn more at BeAPlanner.com. The Be A Planner Show with Nathan Ross.
Like the song, Bobby McGee. I'm just longing to be free. Take me where I want to be. Big dreams and fake dreams. And there are many just like with big dreams and faded dreams.
Okay, welcome back to the final segment of this week's Be A Planner Show with Nathan Ross, CPA. And I wanted to circle back to the federal budget once again. And, you know, we talk about discretionary and non-discretionary spending. And I want to give you some examples of those categories. I want to mention once again that if you have questions, feel free to text me during the show or during the week, 713-581-0195, and I'll be happy, depending on the topic, to answer that question on a future show or maybe the current show if it's relevant to what we're talking about. But in any event, so discretionary spending, well, let's talk about mandatory or non-discretionary. 61% of the federal budget is mandatory spending, and I'm going to assume this is, you know, up to the minute. It looks like this article is fairly recent. But the federal budget's divided into three main categories. We've got the mandatory, or the what I would refer to as the non-discretionary spending. Then we've got discretionary spending, which is about 26% of the budget. And then we have interest on debt, which at the moment is the smallest component of the federal budget. It's interest on the national debt. Discretionary spending requires action from Congress, and that's why we talk about, or I've mentioned many times on the air, discretionary spending is the part we argue about in Congress. And Congress is the body that passes laws to establish and fund those discretionary programs. And this is one reason why, as a political party, you want to have the majority in the House of Representatives. That's where all the action starts, the House Ways and Means Committee. And if you control the purse, as it were, well, then you tend to have more control over the discretionary spending. Again, that 26% component, according to this article, of the federal budget. And, you know, the discretionary spending requires action from Congress to continue, is the bottom line. And so Congress passes laws that establishes and funds those programs. Once the funds run out, the department or departments involved cannot spend more unless Congress approves the additional funding. And some examples of discretionary spending include defense, education, transportation, environmental protection, law enforcement, border security, and international assistance. Those are some of the larger examples of the discretionary component of the budget. And, you know, of the categories, 21% is national defense. This is of the overall federal budget. 18% is national defense. 15% is on health, I believe health and human services. 14% is the net interest expense that we pay. 13% is Medicare. So again, Medicare and Social Security are a whopping 34% of the annual budget. And therein lies one of the biggest issues coming down the tracks at us, because folks, we're not getting any younger in our country. In fact, we're getting older and we're living longer, and it really puts stress on the Social Security system and Medicare system, because there's not enough youth workers. So, you know, when you back up and look at Social Security and Medicare historically, when those programs first originated, we had roughly nine people, I believe it was. It was, you know, somewhere between eight and nine people, younger people, paying in to the programs to support every person, every one person that was taking money out or receiving benefit payments. Now, I believe we're down to somewhere between two and three people that are working to support each recipient. Not going to go forever like that. It can't. And unfortunately, our birth rates are declining. And for all of us that, you know, want to control our borders, and we do need borders, I don't want to misconstrue what, or have you misconstrue what I'm saying. We need the good workers coming in. We don't need the bad characters. And, you know from listening to the news lately who they are. But we need all of the folks we can get that will help grow the economy. And let's face it, if we grow GDP, if we could somehow plant a new GDP tree or two or three, we'd have no problems, because the tax revenues would go up significantly and handle this deficit. But that's not how it works. And so we've got to work on growing the GDP, and that takes people. You got to have people to do the work, and they've got to be the type of people that aren't costing you billions of dollars a year to fund their being here. And unfortunately, that's what we've got now due to the, you know, open border policy of the last 4 years. And that's just another reason why it's going to stop. It's not just the crime. It's because we can't afford it. But anyway, you know, you look at federal spending, and let me go to the usaspending.gov. It's a interesting site in terms of what we spend our money on now. Let's see here. Guess some people might say, well, we could cut spending, but not spending money on these kind of websites, right? But anyway, let's see here. I was looking for, the interest on the debt. Current year, 1.15 trillion, and this is kind of again the example of different economists looking through different windows into the same room. So far this year, the federal government plans to spend 9.68 trillion, including 1.36 on national defense. So, you know, U.S. debt clock has national defense. It's somewhere just under a trillion. So again, I'm not sure what the economists at USAspending.gov are looking at to explain that difference. Veterans benefits is a $368 billion number. See, we don't think about that when we talk about going to war. We don't think about the long tail, T-A-I-L, of those benefit payments. People get hurt. People have health care issues beyond getting hurt in war that VA covers. And it's just crazy how much it all adds up. And if you look at spending by budget function, this is fiscal year 2024. Let's see, I've already gone over some of these numbers. Let's drill down a little bit further. The general government operations administration is right at 5%. It's $477 billion. Education, training, employment, and social services is $270 billion. That's 2.8%. Let's see, what's another good category? Natural resources and environment, 1.6%, $155 billion goes into that pot. And community and regional development, 1.2%, that's $112.6 billion. These are just huge amounts of money that make up the $7 trillion that we're currently expending. Here's one you'll like, Administration of Justice. I presume that's the DOJ or the Department of Justice by itself. This is at the federal level now. This doesn't count the states. $107 billion, or a total of 1.1%. International Affairs, another $102 billion. Commerce and Housing Credit, excuse me, $159 billion. Transportation, 1.8%, that's $177 billion. General Science, Space, and Technology, $45.2 billion. And Energy, $40.3 billion. That's a lot. I'm sorry, I just don't believe that we can't cut a couple trillion dollars, you know, off of those categories. I mean, I go back to a DOD contractor, the Department of Defense contractor once that told me that if they didn't increase their budget ask each year by 30%, they wouldn't get what they got the prior year. And that's just crazy. Anyway, we're at the end of the show, and I want to remind you that I am available if you want to send a text to 713-581-0195 if you have some questions, and we hope you can join us again this coming Friday at 11 a.m. right here on AM 700 KSEV, The Voice of Texas. Thank you for listening.
Thanks for listening, and join us again next week for another edition of Be a Planner Show with Nathan Ross, CPA. Ooh.